Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For much of our nation's history, the only way to get a message to the president was to send a letter. Now you can message the White House on Facebook using Messenger chatbots. Commerce has embraced the trend as well. In July, Whole Foods Market deployed a chatbot that allows customers to find and brainstorm about recipes. And Pizza Hut set up a chatbot for ordering pizza directly through Facebook Messenger. So it's a thing. Joining us now is writer and Silicon Valley veteran Chris Messina. He has worked for Google, invented the Twitter hashtag, and now works for Uber. His recent article on chatbots appeared at backchannel.com. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Facebook Messenger bots, what are they? How do they compare and contrast with just regular Messenger or other communication apps?
Yeah, you know, the biggest way I think to understand the shift that's going on is to recognize that brands, companies, and other sorts of software are starting to show up in the messaging context. So where we used to use messaging, whether it was SMS, texting, iMessage, Facebook Messenger, and so on, to just talk to our friends and family and people that we knew well, businesses are starting to appear there. And of course, for us, if we are talking to, you know, five or six of our friends on a regular basis, for businesses, obviously, they're going to be speaking to thousands of their customers. And the way to scale their ability to talk to all those customers in parallel is to use automated systems, which are being called bots. And so, you know, your example with Whole Foods allowed them to create some software that would conversationally talk to their customers about what kinds of things they might be shopping for, and then to look up in their database recipes that might match those ingredients and then give them suggestions automatically without relying on a person being part of that conversation.
And they don't necessarily tell you they're a bot. You could think, if you didn't know better, that it was a person.
In some cases, for sure. We are getting better and better, and by we, I mean the technology industry, at simulating human speech. So if you had an experience, and I think this sort of fits into the conversational software paradigm, where you talk to either Siri or Microsoft's Cortana or the Google Assistant, for example, they're able to talk to you in a fairly human-sounding way, and you may not even be thinking or recognizing that who you're interacting with is actually just a program.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about chatbots. You may not know it, but they're talking to you more and more. My guest is Chris Messina. He's a writer and developer experience lead at Uber. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, for years, it seemed like every company needed its own app. Is it now the case that they're going to need their own chatbot? Is this a must-have sort of a thing?
You know, I think it's really important to look at the evolution of technology over time and how technology fits into people's lives. And what we're seeing is that there's what you might call app fatigue happening, where a lot of these companies, of course, have asked their users to download and install apps and then to learn the interfaces of those apps. But they're all a little bit different, and they all add a little more friction to your life. So by moving into the messaging context, now suddenly there's a universal way of interacting with all these services that don't require people to have to learn new interfaces. So I think it's actually going to be a shift that makes companies and services a lot more accessible. And then in some cases, in fact, many cases, downloading and installing an app may be a necessary part of the experience. So a good example of that is actually Uber. If you are talking to a friend and you give them an address or say, oh, I need to get a ride to go meet you, Facebook will actually attach a button that says get a ride to the little chat bubble. And so right within Facebook Messenger, you can request a ride from Uber without even installing or downloading the app, which is super convenient. However, if you're a daily user of Uber, then you want to be able to have the app, and so you can open it up and you can have the full map experience. You can manage your payment cards and so on and so forth in a way that is optimized and designed by people who are really focused on that problem. So I think it's a spectrum.
When Facebook's saying, do you want to ride? I mean, don't you have to download the app at that point?
No. Mm-mm. That's the thing that's amazing. These services are actually being built into the conversation platforms themselves.
But with Uber, how do you pay for it then? I mean, how does that work?
So in that case, Facebook actually allows you to put a card on file associated with your Facebook account.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. If there are other bots and digital assistants available, you know, such as Siri, Amazon Echo, Facebook Messenger, and now Facebook and Google are teaming up to create MasterBot, won't all of these bots just overlap each other? I mean, are you going to get, does it matter to the consumer if they even know what bot's working at what time?
Well, this is sort of the next big play, I think, for to be sort of a dominant platform in your life.
Okay.
And they're all taking different approaches to this problem. You know, I think if you look at the Amazon Echo, which I would call a room computer, it's sort of something that sits there and listens for you to say, hey, you know, Alexa, you know, what's the weather? Amazon is trying to make it easier and easier for you to interact with their services, primarily through shopping, right? So when you run out of something, instead of having to pull open your phone or go to your desktop computer and do a search on Amazon, you can just ask Alexa to do it for you. That means you're probably going to do a lot more shopping through Alexa and with Amazon than you would otherwise. In Apple's case, they've just, with the iPhone 7, released these new earphones called AirPods, mm-hmm. and they allow you to talk to Siri. So you can imagine having these, you know, AirPods in your head all day, you're listening to music, and then in that case, you know, you want to order something or you want to get an Uber. In that case, Siri now supports Uber. You can be like, oh, I need a ride, and then Siri will be able to execute that for you. So these companies are trying to get closer and closer and woven more into your life, so that they can offer you more convenience. And so you're turning to them more frequently than you would any of the competitors.
So in your article, you posed the question, why bots and why now? And it's because they make money.
Sure. And it's a way of reducing a lot of friction. I think, you know, we've lived through this era where a lot of our computing experiences were driven by the workplace. And the Microsoft paradigm of offering and delivering apps that had increasing functionality led to a lot of, I think, you know, confusion and frustration, where there's just like, oh my God, technology is taking over my life. Mm-hmm. If you can move to a conversational paradigm and you can interact with apps and services the same way that you interact with your friends, where, you know, I could call you or I could text you or I could do video chat, and it feels very natural to me, and we're interacting in a way that uses my language in the way that I understand the world, that's a lot more accessible and requires a lot less thought. And so we're shifting, I think, our technology experiences to be a lot more human and humane than forcing people to learn to be more like computers and to think more the way that computers think.
Some don't believe that the bot craze will last. You do. Why?
Sure. It's important, I think, for me, it's less about bots per se. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more about the shift towards conversational interfaces. And I think this is being driven largely because especially young people are starting to expect and experience access to computers and the internet wherever they go, whatever they do. You know, it's sort of one of those tropes that young children will go and try and touch the TV expecting it to be a large touchscreen. Mm-hmm. And so those expectations are being built in. You know, I've got a 7 and 11-year-old with me at home, and the things that they ask Siri to do for them or ask Alexa to do for them are things that I would never even think to imagine. But they're growing up with these technologies, and they're going to expect that anywhere that they go, you know, if they're in a car or they're in someone's house or they're looking at a TV or a screen, that they should be able to just say what they want and that the computer will figure it out for them, as opposed to having to figure out an app, to download the app, to install it, to go through that whole process of setting up an account. All that friction is stuff that we've learned to deal with. I think the younger generation is just not going to put up with it.
You set up your own chatbot on Facebook, and that's how my producer, Michael DeBonis, first made contact with you. What was that process like?
Yeah, actually, this is the first time that my bot has ever sort of fielded an interview for me. but it's available at m.me/MessinaBot. And the idea of the bot for me, you know, I end up getting a lot of email and a lot of inbound requests. And so it turns out that I don't scale. And so my bot sort of receives a lot of these inbound requests and will respond to them in somewhat automated ways. So, for example, if, you know, you would like to schedule some office hours with me to talk about, you know, products or technology or whatever, my bot can do that for you. If you want to find out where I've left Foursquare tips and recommendations for things that I've liked in the world, my bot can give you that information. If you like my cocktail recipes, my bot can also give you that information. So in a way, you know, we've kind of deconstructed ourselves into using all these different social networks and apps. They're publishing information about stuff that we're into. The problem, though, is that, you know, we're complex people, and aggregating that information into a single source has been really difficult. And so my bot kind of does that for me and creates a more holistic picture that I want to share about information that I put out there in the public that I'm interested in allowing people to have access to. And so my bot sort of is a first line of defense, I guess, about all those inbound requests that previously I used to have to deal with one at a time, you know?
You know, the whole bot thing, it's a form of AI, artificial intelligence, right?
Well, there's a mix there. Some bots do use AI. Other bots are very just simple scripted kind of programs, kind of like if you've ever called into a support line and they kind of walk you through a tree. Mm-hmm. There are bots that are programmed like that that just sort of say, you know, here are the things that I can do for you. Which would you like? You know, mm-hmm. Press 1, 2, or 3. For the AI-based bot, I think there's a lot less forgiveness right now. And so we're in this world where the AI is not quite good enough. The applications are not quite compelling enough, and we don't know what the best use cases are going to be. And so a lot of the experiences that I think people are going to have are going to be somewhat disappointing. But, you know, just like the iPhone apps in 2007, you know, 10 years ago, were also pretty disappointing. If you give it enough time, these things are going to start to get really, really good. Mm-hmm. And you're going to start to expect almost all of the applications and all of the physical devices that you have in your life to have some kind of interactivity. You know, like right now, we don't expect to be able to talk to the lights in our house, but that's going to become very common soon, where you can say, hey, you know, light, you know, can you turn to like sort of a nice amber glow, you know, maybe 50% brightness because it's the evening and stuff like that. Or you can talk to, let's say, Nest in the future and ask your house to, you know, turn to like 65 degrees when it's like really, really hot outside. The fact that we have to go and manually interact with these things today is sort of a vestige of a previous era of hardware design, and that's quickly, I think, evolving.
Do you think it ever evolves to the point of, say, you know, like that movie Her, where it's just kind of every part of your existence?
Absolutely. I mean, and while on the one hand that can be scary and intimidating, on the other hand, again, we're spending, and I know myself, and maybe I'm an outlier, but I spent a lot of time trying to adapt my behavior to my phone or my computer and trying to remember where I left this thing or where I left that thing and mm-hmm. what time is my appointment and how to get to this place and which app to use for this other thing. All of these ways that I've changed my thinking to adapt to my computing environment it means that I'm spending a lot of attention and my thoughts just doing that, as opposed to doing the harder, more interesting problems of making choices and decisions. And interacting with friends and people that I care about. So, you know, with the AirPods in particular, which Apple just released, right. They're moving in that direction. Sony actually has a product as well called Xperia Ear, I think, which they previewed in February, and they're moving in that direction as well. So if you've ever noticed, you know, the people who are wearing these Bluetooth headsets, you know, to talk to their business colleagues or whatever on the phone, that's kind of the behavior that looks a lot like what you see Joaquin Phoenix doing in Her. Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking to a bot or you're talking to your boss is, of course, going to be something that's going to be something we don't even notice in the future. And again, I think a lot of young people are going to be very willing to do this because they're using it in gaming headsets today. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right. As far as companies go, I mean, the way this is all headed, I mean, I was going to ask you how easy or difficult it is for companies to set up their own bot service, but I guess who's ever got these services are making it very, very easy.
It really depends on the level of complexity that you're willing to build.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's some very, very complex bots that are out there. Google just launched a new program for messaging called Allo, and it features the Google Assistant, and you can have essentially a conversation with it. And it's a bot, it's an artificial intelligence, but it feels like it's actually got a personality and you're talking to it. But that's Google's take on the problem. There are a lot of other companies that are starting much more basic and much more simple. And in fact, in other cases, these are just conduits to talk to customer service agents or humans. In the case of Uber, for example, if you talk to Uber through Facebook Messenger, we staff that with live humans, like real people. And the reason is because, of course, when you're out in the world and you're looking for your Uber and you're trying to find and connect with the driver, that's a very or potentially very stressful moment. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have to talk to a bot that doesn't have empathy, that doesn't understand the human sort of experience. You want a person who's going to be sort of like, oh, man, like that really sucks. Let's see what we can do to help you out. And so we've actually made that strategic decision to focus on that for now. So there's a whole spectrum of ways of approaching building either bots or entering into the messaging space. And I think each business and company that's in there needs to really think critically about the service that they're providing or what their users' needs are.
You said for now when it comes to having that human experience with Uber, but
yes,
you're anticipating that someday the bots can become more sophisticated and have that empathy component to it.
Yeah, and I think it's both, too, where what I hope happens is that bots and automated systems augment humans' ability to help each other, to serve each other, right? For example, let's say you forget your Uber password. You know, that's something that actually happens quite often. So, you know, you don't necessarily need to talk to a human for that. And furthermore, maybe you shouldn't, because it's more secure to talk to an automated system where there's not a human on the other end that's going to, you know, hear your password reset to the command and so on. So there may be cases like that where it makes sense for a human to hand off to a bot or for a bot to hand off to a human and for them to actually cooperate to provide a better service.
Well, Chris Messina, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's interesting. I appreciate your time.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Chris Messina, writer and developer experience lead at Uber. And we'll post a link to his article about the Facebook Messenger bot and all the other bots out there that you're interacting with and you might not even know it. We will have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, Yahoo admitted that a hack of their servers has left 500 million accounts vulnerable. Yahoo encouraged users to change and strengthen their passwords to protect the privacy of their emails. But if the federal government wanted to read your emails, that tactic wouldn't work. Federal agencies can read all your email, and you might never even know about it. Joining us now is Clark Cunningham. He's professor of law and ethics at Georgia State University School of Law. He recently wrote about this issue at theconversation.com and his article, Apple and the American Revolution, Remembering Why We Have the Fourth Amendment, will be published by Yale Law School next month. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Fisher.
Could you describe how the government could get access to someone's emails, whether it's Yahoo or not?
Certainly. It's a multiple-step process, but as soon as your email is stored on the cloud, as is the case, I think, for most email accounts today, the government has a process where it can get a search warrant, serve the search warrant on Microsoft or Yahoo or whoever else is your email provider, and get all of your email copied over directly from that remote service provider without your knowledge. And once they get that email, the evidence indicates that they have a practice of looking at all of it if they want to.
Can they just randomly get this kind of authority, or do they have to apply for it? They have to get a search warrant, right?
They do have to get a search warrant. But unfortunately, the court cases that are going on right now are showing that they are not following legal procedures in getting those search warrants. A search warrant is supposed to be very limited. So, for example, if the police have probable cause to believe that you have a stolen bicycle in your house, they can get a search warrant on an affidavit from someone that says, I have probable cause to believe that stolen bicycle is in Ann's house. They then come to your house, knock on the door, show you the search warrant. You can see the search warrant. You see what it's for. Mm-hmm. You let them in. They look for where they might be able to find a bicycle. If they find the bicycle, they leave. If they don't find the bicycle, they leave. They can't look in dresser drawers. They can't look in your places where you wouldn't find a bicycle. That's the way it's supposed to work. But when we're talking about digital information, the search warrant protections have failed us, because what they're doing is they're getting a search warrant that allows them to download the entire content of your email from the very first day you opened up an account, not limited it in any way to email that might be evidence of a crime, And then they write into the warrant the ability to look through everything. So instead of coming to your house and looking for a bicycle, they come to your house and look at everything.
So is that sort of the same thing as when someone, you know, police pull you over for speeding, but they find that you have an open beer in the seat next to you and they can get you for that too?
It's much worse than that.
Okay.
No, it's much worse than that. When the police pull you over, they're still limited in what they can do.
Okay.
Pretty much they have to be looking in the car to protect themselves. They have to see something in plain view. Here, what they're doing is getting access to all of your email for years and years and years. And then they say, we may be looking for evidence of this crime or that crime, but they're looking at everything. And there's nothing in the current law that protects us from them using anything else they find while they're doing that search.
The key to the federal government accessing email is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It was passed way back in 1986, you know, before I had email. Describe how that law comes into play here.
Right, and that's the problem, is it's very outdated. First of all, it operates on the assumption that our email is not our property, but it's the property of the company that's storing the email. So that's why they give the search warrant to Microsoft. They don't give it to us.
Okay.
The additional problems are, so we don't get the search warrant to begin with. The next problem is that the government routinely gets orders to seal the court files. Normally, a search warrant or anything else would be a matter of public record. So if we don't get the search warrant, we could look at the court files. They seal the court files in almost all these cases, so there's nothing in the court file. And then this is the issue that the Microsoft Corporation is suing the Department of Justice about right now. In most of these cases, they get gag orders to prevent Microsoft or Yahoo or Google from telling you they've received a search warrant. The latest data I've seen from the Microsoft versus Department of Justice case is in the last 18 months, there have been over 9,000 of these gag orders served on the various email providers and other electronic storage companies.
What are the tech companies doing? You mentioned the court case with Microsoft.
Right. So Microsoft has taken the lead on this. They filed a lawsuit in Seattle asking for the court to declare that the Electronic Communication Privacy Act gag rule is unconstitutional, that it deprives customers like you and me of the right to know when the government is getting a search warrant to look at our email. If we got notice of it, we could challenge the legality of the search warrant and say it's overbroad, they're going beyond what they should be doing, but the whole thing is cloaked in secrecy. All of the major cloud-based companies have joined with friend of the court briefs with Microsoft. All the major news organizations are supporting the position. And most remarkably, the chief federal prosecutors for Seattle for over 20 years serving both Republican and Democratic administrations, they have filed a brief supporting the Microsoft position, joined by the retired head of the FBI office in Seattle.
Well, good grief. Who's against it then?
No one has filed a friend of the court brief in support of the government that I'm aware of.
Is the government just acting like a robot at this point? I mean, are they thinking about it, changing it? Is anybody looking at that?
Well, there's certainly a need for Congress to act, and that's how I end my article that's going to be published by Yale, is we really need congressional action that takes a look at the larger problems and comes up with new legislation. Fortunately, as a result of the big controversy earlier this year, it's called FBI versus Apple, where the FBI tried to force Apple to break the iPhone security system. That got a lot of media attention. It got the attention of Congress. Congress has a number of bipartisan initiatives. They're proposing a joint bipartisan expert commission to look at the whole question of how to balance our needs for law enforcement versus security and our electronic information. So I'm very hopeful that we'll get new legislation that will bring this under control.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the government can gain access to pretty much anybody's emails and can call for a gag order and keep you from ever learning about it. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Clark Cunningham. He's a professor of law and ethics at Georgia State University School of Law. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. Clark Cunningham, can I figure out if somebody has accessed my email? Is there any way to do that outside of, I mean, I understand I can't call up Microsoft, I can't call up Yahoo and say, have you given access to my email? But can I find out another way?
Absolutely not. If the court file is sealed and there's a gag order, the only way you're ever going to know your email has been read is if the government chooses to tell you, and that's only probably going to happen if they decide to prosecute you. But one of the studies that I've seen suggests that in at least one sample of orders for electronic communication that have been sealed, that less than 10% of those searches lead to a criminal prosecution. So it's entirely possible that the vast majority of people whose email is being read are completely innocent, and they have, and they will never know that the government's been accessing their email. It's really a horrifying situation.
When the government gets a search warrant for emails, they request all the emails on someone's account. You said some would say that that goes beyond the limits of the Fourth Amendment. What's the conflict there now?
The part of it is we very rarely see these warrants because they're sealed because of the gag orders. Mm-hmm. But thanks to another lawsuit that Microsoft filed that was litigated in New York City, we actually got a copy of the warrant in that case, and I actually reproduce it in the article that came out on The Conversation. So if you go to that website, you can actually see the warrant. So we see what it says, and it says all the email from the beginning to the present. And there's, I've seen other cases where that's going on. It's clearly inconsistent with what the Constitution says, which is that a search warrant has to describe the particular things mm-hmm. to be. The government's argument in these cases appears to be that sometimes, you know, criminals can hide email. They can give it a misleading subject line. They can change the date. They can save it as a photograph when it's really a text. And that therefore, for their forensic experts to make sure they can absolutely ferret out any possible evidence of a crime, they need access to the whole database to run their various programs. And that's an argument that the judges have been willing to listen to. But some of the more conscientious judges have come back and said, okay, if you want the whole database, we need to write restrictions into the warrant about how you can search and use what you find. And that's something the government has consistently resisted.
Why?
That's a good question. From their perspective, the more they can find, the better. What's really happened is old-fashioned search warrants, the kind of thing you see on Law & Order and CSI where they get a warrant to search a house or mm-hmm. something, those have almost disappeared. They've been completely taken over by these warrants to search electronic information because it is so much easier for law enforcement to grab all our email and look through that for incriminating statements than it is for them to do traditional criminal investigation.
Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
Okay, this is about time, okay? And I have to go back to the seeds where all of this was planted, and that was a very terrified Democratic Congress after 9/11 and a particularly aggressive presidential thing. It was the Patriot Act. That was the seed of all of this.
Well, I mean, but it, do you agree, Clark Cunningham, or you said it goes all the way back to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, but did the use of this, was it spurred on by 9/11?
Certainly there are issues with the Patriot Act, and I appreciate the caller mentioning that, but the provisions that I'm looking at have been around since 1986, and there's been a lot of use of that. I think the fact that it's taken off is more the result of the fact that we are now using our cell phones to access our email, and we're using cloud-based email. That's a relatively recent development. Back in the days when people didn't use email all the time or it was located on a physical server inside your office, it was a lot harder for the government. But now all they have to do is as soon as they find out what kind of email you use, they just have to send a piece of paper to a company like Microsoft and get a database download, and they're off and running. So I think the explosion of this is more of the fact that we are relying so much more on email, which is located in the cloud. I think that's really the vulnerability that the government is exploiting.
Dale, thanks for that call. And you mentioned conscientious judges are trying to write into the warrants or the sealed warrants and so forth, limitations. How are judges responding to this whole thing?
Well, again, the problem is that we don't know very much of what's going on because it's all cloaked in secrecy. But there's these cases are actually handled by federal magistrate judges. They're kind of at the lowest level of the court system.
Right.
And so what they do is generally not observed or published. But the former chief magistrate in Washington, D.C., and a magistrate in Kansas City both have decided to start publishing opinions, which have become a matter of public record, about this problem. And so we have a series of published opinions by those two judges explaining how serious this problem is and refusing to sign these warrants. But the problem is that these things rotate. There are multiple magistrates, so the government could just wait a month and come back when there's another magistrate on duty who apparently probably is willing to sign these. And we just have there maybe three or four or five other federal judges who've gone on the record saying that this is a problem. But as far as we can tell, certainly the Microsoft case indicates that judges are generally signing these warrants. And because we don't know about it, we have no opportunity to go into court and challenge in the normal way that we have in a democracy.
Is it just emails or are text messages?
No. These orders typically ask for the entire account, and they specifically say text messages, photographs, videos, contact lists. Often they want all the information about where you've been doing your web browsing, so they know all the websites you visited, anything you have remotely. So it's not just email. If you use an iCloud backup for your phone, if you use NetDrive, all of that stuff the government can go after. And if they get your physical cell phone, they get the same kind of search warrant, and they create a clone of the phone, and everything that's on your phone they have access to, which is an amazing amount of personal information.
Well, it's making me think about the objections that librarians have when they've tried to get, in the past, people's reading lists and that kind of a thing. That's private.
Right. The problem is, what I'm hoping is the high-profile litigation that Microsoft brought, the fight that Apple put up against FBI last spring, is going to bring this to public consciousness. And the average citizen can realize that this is something that affects them. The problem that we've had for decades is the protections of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures. People have thought that's all about, technicalities that criminal defendants bring up. And they're guilty anyway. And so these constitutional rights are not perceived by the average citizen as important to them. But these cases, this kind of information shows that these protections are essential for us to have a free society.
Clark Cunningham, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Clark Cunningham is a professor of law and ethics at Georgia State University School of Law. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We spoke earlier about chatbots. Google recently released a messaging app called Allo, and it has a virtual assistant chatbot. The app was released last week to mixed reviews. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So how is Allo different from other messaging apps?
The core behind Google Allo is this assistant feature where you can be having a conversation with someone and you can decide, you're planning a place to go for dinner that evening, and you can actually search, locations or restaurant times, anything like that from inside the conversation in such a way that both parties can see the information that you search for immediately and can, make decisions based on that information without ever having to leave the app.
So what was it like? You've done it, right? Or one of your colleagues has?
I've used it for about a week now, and it's weird. It takes a little getting used to when you think about there being, you know, kind of, the presentation is almost like there's a third person in the conversation with you that you can just kind of ask every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to ask this question of Google, you are asking kind of in the conversation format, and the responses that you get are based, you know, kind of in that response where it'll show up as kind of a chat bubble that everyone can see. And so that's a little odd at first. And it doesn't actually get easier to deal with when you have group conversations, because there may be a conversation going on where three or four people in a group of, say, 10 are having a conversation, and Google kind of is filling in and chiming in with information as you ask it. And so it takes a little getting used to.
How do you ask it? So you got three people, you're all talking, and then what do you do?
You directly message Google. You use almost like on Twitter, where you would use the @ sign and then Google. You would type in the word Google, and it will highlight Google, and then you just ask a question, in a text format, in a very natural kind of conversation format, and it will present you with responses right away. You can ask it questions as though you were asking a person in that very chatbot kind of style,
uh-huh.
And you'll get responses that either have direct Google search responses, or times, you know, that are available, you know, things that you would be able to otherwise search.
We've been talking about chatbots being just built into things like Facebook and that sort of thing. Allo, you need an app for it. Do you think it's going to catch on?
I think that the core here is providing use. And the problem we're running into with all of these chatbots right now is that they're still very limited. They're still very technical. And very few of them have crossed that kind of conversation gap where it feels like there's an actual contribution to the conversation, and not like you're just opening up Google search and searching for something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that we are closer than we have been in previous years with chatbots, because this is not a new concept by any stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But the struggle here is going to be which one of these companies that is working on these chatbots, that are built into things, is going to make it the most natural feeling to use. And so far, none of them, I feel like, have really hit that mark. And that's kind of the point. You know, Google is all about, releasing something and letting, you know, millions of people use it, and then gathering that information from their use and using it to enhance that product. It's worked for Google Maps. It's worked for Gmail. It's worked for all of their products. And it's something that they've done in a way that very few other companies have been able to pull off over time. But it's still kind of a weird experience. And when you're dealing with something like text messages, where you have features, services like Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp and just normal text messages, you know, convincing people to use something that doesn't quite work all the way is a big ask.
When you're using Allo, if you have the app, do the people that you're also having a conversation with, do they need the app too to see the bubble?
They do not need the app to see the bubble. It will show up like a normal text message.
Okay.
So if I were to send a text message to my sister, you know, who is not using Google Allo, then it shows up as a normal text message and says that the message has come from me. It doesn't come from my number. It comes from a third party, but it identifies me clearly in the message.
Hmm.
And that allows someone to respond and have that show up in my app. So it's not an immediate requirement that you have Allo installed, but there are links in those conversations that invite you to then go and install Allo to get more out of that conversation.
Edward Snowden criticized Allo on his Twitter account. He called it Google surveillance. Isn't that the case with anything Google does? How is Allo's security? I mean, can it be released?
So this is kind of a frustrating thing, and it takes a little bit out of context. When Allo was originally announced, one of the big features was this kind of end-to-end encryption, you know, where the conversation that you would have with someone would be private, both, you know, with Google and without Google. You could have conversations with this assistant feature, and you know, it would add that kind of richness of having a chatbot and having to not leave the app to do something. But then there would also be this incognito mode where conversations were encrypted end to end, and even Google couldn't see what was happening in those messages. And when Allo got launched, this incognito mode was not the default method of communication. Instead, this you know, Google Assistant thing was the default communication. And so what that means is, in order for Google to provide those kind of search answers and offer you know, responses and things like that, the Google service has to be paying attention to the conversation. And so that means that Google has a record of this conversation, you know, in order to use that information to provide you with the answers that you're looking for. And so Snowden was one of many, you know, people in the security industry who saw Allo and were a little unhappy that the encryption feature is not the default, is not the standard. It's something that you can very easily access. It's something that you can activate with a push of a button. But because it's not the default, it makes it very easy for, I guess, the average person using something like Allo to not know even that it's something you can turn on and just use it and, you know, weirdly get themselves in some kind of imaginary trouble. Were the police to come to Google and say, give us a record of this person's, you know, Allo transcripts, then, if they weren't using encryption, if they weren't using this incognito mode, then Google could be compelled to provide that information.
Right.
But it's still kind of a weird gap to cross in order to get to that point, I think.
Okay, just one more thing to keep our eye on. The new iPhone 7 Plus has a new camera feature, portrait mode. What is portrait mode?
So this is something that we got, you know, kind of a tease of during the Apple announcement, and it was kind of pitched as this new way to take pictures, as though you were taking pictures with a regular DSLR camera. Mm-hmm. And it's a feature that would be available much later in the year. And it turns out that they had it available for you to try out like a week after the iPhone came out. This portrait mode, it uses, you know, because the iPhone 7 Plus has these two lenses on the back that you can switch back and forth between. It actually leverages those two lenses, which can kind of give you depth information to create artificial depth of field. And so what that means is you can take a picture of something that's, you know, close, a person or an object that's close, and have the background, you know, kind of look blurred as though it were taken with a very high-end camera. And so it gives it kind of an arty look to the back of the photo as well.
Oh, okay. And is it beta testing now, or is it available? What's the deal?
This is a new feature that anybody can take advantage of, but Apple makes it very clear that it's something that they are working on internally.
Okay.
You know, so they are going to continue to improve it over time.
Okay, so no promises.
Right. And so this is not the first, you know, service to you know, be available that creates this kind of shallow depth of field. It's this really interesting technique, you know, that you know, large cameras with you know, very large sensors and lenses, you know, used to great effect, because it's actually focusing on something in the foreground with you know, no attempt to focus on anything in the background. Mm-hmm. And so it creates this kind of very arty look. And this lens attempts to kind of artificially create that. And to some success, you know, there have been a lot of photos that have shown up that have looked very nice from the tests that have been done so far. But in many cases, because this is still very early, and because, you know, smartphone lenses and sensors really aren't built to do this kind of thing in, you know, in a practical way, you'll often find pictures where it partially works, and in some cases, you know, kind of the edge of the person that you were trying to take a picture of is now also blurry.
Okay. is it just a matter of time before our phones become these fancy cameras?
It's, you know, it's a narrative that keeps being pushed by the people who are selling these things, and I kind of remain unconvinced. I am not very good with large professional cameras, but I have lots of amazing conversations with people who are very good with these cameras, and I've seen them, you know, do just incredible things with cameras that you know, it would be, you know, it's a matter of physics. You know, really the way that the lenses work on these mm-hmm. large lenses that are just never going to work on the back of a phone.
Do you see camera companies innovating to compete with people's phones?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Over the last, you know, year in particular, we've seen a whole bunch of simple point and shoot cameras be released with software that adds filters that allows you to kind of instantly publish to Facebook when you have access to Wi-Fi and things like that, trying to mimic these kind of smartphone features that add to that, you know, just sheer convenience of having the camera on a thing that is connected to the internet. And, you know, so we're we're seeing a lot of that, you know, where you can do a lot of the stuff, you know, straight on the camera. And then as soon as you are connected to a Wi-Fi network, you can just immediately upload everything and not have to worry about dealing with the card and the, you know, connecting it to a laptop or anything like that. It just is available somewhere for you to look at, often through your phone.
Snapchat. It's introducing a new product called Spectacles. What are Snapchat Spectacles? How do they work?
This is very interesting. It's actually kind of a series of weird small announcements. The first was that Snapchat is no longer the name of the company. It is now Snap is the name of the company. And I guess the purpose there was that they were going to be doing more than just the Snapchat app. Mm-hmm. And these spectacles are a way of dealing with this. And it is a pair of sunglasses that have cameras built into the frame. The idea here being that you can tap the side of the frame and capture 10 seconds of video for whatever it is immediately in front of you, and have that available to share on Snapchat.
Why just sunglasses?
I think the idea is that you are, this is something that you would do while you're out kind of enjoying life. You know, maybe you're out playing with kids, or you're going for a jog and you see something or something like that. It's a, you know, kind of an attempt to make it so that you don't have to kind of step out of the moment that you are in, mm-hmm. in order to capture it.
Which is a big deal because there's all kinds of criticism of people walking around with their phones all the time.
Right. And so this is kind of an effort to take advantage of that conversation, you know, with a piece of hardware. And this is a $130 pair of sunglasses that have a very obvious looking, you know, camera built into the frame with this kind of notch out in the lens so that you can tell that it's there and the lens lights up when you go to take a video of something. So it becomes kind of obvious. But when you're not using it, then they just kind of look like highly stylized sunglasses.
Was this something, one of the things that the erstwhile Google Glass was trying to achieve?
Google Glass had a camera built into it, mm-hmm. and could be used to take pictures and video, among just many other things. But it was built to be this kind of display that you had hovering in front of you that you could interact with, that, you know, communicated with your phone. Whereas this is explicitly for taking pictures or rather for recording that 10 seconds of video and then having it available to do things on your phone. There's no display here or settings to mess with. This is the glasses have a single button for a single purpose, and everything else is done on the phone.
Now, Google Glass got some pushback because of privacy concerns. What about the spectacles? Is that going to be an issue?
Unsurprisingly, there is significantly less concern about privacy when it comes to this for some bizarre reasons. The first being that, you know, Snapchat was designed at first to be kind of ephemeral. So, you know, messages erase themselves after 24 hours, even though it's, you know, that's no longer really how that works. And it's
right.
been demonstrated on several occasions that you can record things from Snapchat with, you know, pretty significant ease. The Snapchat kind of core audience seems really unconcerned with privacy as a whole. And that's kind of the target audience, is, you know, the people who are already using Snapchat who want that kind of additional feature. And, you know, as unfortunate as this sounds, I think the majority of the people who raise these privacy concerns don't actually even have Snapchat accounts right now. I am certainly guilty of that, having never actually used Snapchat myself. So it's one of those things that, you know, this is a very specific audience that they're trying to target, who would be interested in spending this, you know, fairly trivial $130 to be able to post more things in, you know, kind of this more stylized fashion on Snapchat.
Yeah, in other words, millennials.
You know, I'm sure that is, you know, the marketing term. It's always funny that, you know, millennials is a marketing term, and I don't actually think it refers to a real demographic anymore.
I'm getting kind of tired of it, too.
But yeah, there's, you know, it's definitely a younger group of people that are the target here, and you can see it in the small bit of marketing and advertising that's available for it already. And it's something that we will see later this fall and judge, you know, pretty quickly how successful it is. But they come in a series of colors that look really ostentatious in just about every photo that I've seen them in, aside from the kind of flat black.
Russell Holley, thanks as always. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.